Hello again, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brian McClanahan, and our topic for discussion today is secession. Now, this is a wonderful topic, something that I think everyone needs to know more about. The idea of secession, of course, is the American tradition. And when we get to 1860 and 1861, when it actually happens, there's a lot of discussion about secession and what it means and if it's legal. Abraham Lincoln, of course, said it's not. But he was being pretty disingenuous there, and he obviously didn't understand the history of the United States. And during the Gettysburg Address, obviously doesn't understand the history of the United States. So secession is perhaps one of the most important topics in American history. We wouldn't be here without it. And the history of secession dates back, going back to, of course, 1776. But even beyond that, when you start looking at the North, it was the Northern states who first discussed the idea of secession. And then this idea was carried forward by various groups, ultimately culminating in the secession of the southern states, both de facto and de jure, in 1860 and 1861. So if we better understood secession, if we better understood this particular topic, I think our view of the war between the states, our view of American government would be drastically different. This is not something just fabricated out of thin air by a bunch of radical right-wingers. As I mentioned in our discussion with the antebellum commentaries, there was William Rawl, the Federalist from Pennsylvania, saying that the states had a right to secede. And other commentators said essentially the same thing, that if there was an act of revolution or this was the will of the people, self-determination, you could do this. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you can secede and nothing in the Constitution that says you can't secede. So that really is the topic of discussion, the constitutionality of secession. This topic has even been brought up on the discussion threads for Liberty Classroom, and there have been some great answers about that, both from students and also faculty. And I felt like it was time to delve a little bit deeper into that, because oftentimes you're going to argue with your friends. Well, your Harvard law professor friend is going to say, well, you know, you can't secede because you don't even understand contract law or whatever the case may be. Some Ivy League friend of yours gets into this issue and has no idea what they're talking about. This is the best way to defeat them in an argument over secession. I think after you look at this, and if you take into account everything we've talked about in this course, you can just throttle your friends who start to get into a debate with you about the meaning of the American Union, because again, this is what we're talking about here. What kind of union do we have? And of course, the idea of secession, self-determination, nullification, all these particular issues in this course are brought out into a more clear, concise way for you to understand them. One thing I have to say, and I've said this several times in other presentations about Liberty Classroom, this thing is great in this particular way, that everyone that I've come across who's been engaged in Liberty Classroom has been a real student of American government. And I'm amazed at how much knowledge is actually out there outside of the faculty. And the discussions I've had are tremendous. And I applaud each one of you for taking the time to be involved in Liberty Classroom and learning these things. I mean, we've given you some of the tools to go out and learn more of this stuff for yourself, and that's the whole point of this. I want people, when they leave this particular course and they leave Liberty Classroom, and I want them to have as much knowledge as I have, if not more, about the topic, because that's the only way we're going to win this. And I think that with Ron Paul focusing on younger people and the Liberty Movement, and of course, you know, paleoconservatism and some of these other things that are out there that are really focusing on these particular issues of federalism, that's how we're going to win. And secession is the heart of that, because it goes back to the idea of the sovereignty of the people of the states, and not just that of the local communities, and the power of the local over the power of the central. And that's what it all comes down to. You know, self-determination, if we don't have that, then we really have nothing. And as John C. Calhoun said, you know, if the Union means nothing if we don't have our liberty. So let's get into this issue of secession. It's a lot of fun. All right, is it a constitutional issue? Well, absolutely. And so when you look at the history of secession, when you look at the American War for Independence, it's a war for secession. The 13 independent states, free and independent states, as Thomas Jefferson called them, seceded from the British Empire and were recognized as such in 1783 with the peace treaty that the states signed with Great Britain. So you had 13 independent, free and independent states of North America, stretching from the northern area of, you know, Massachusetts and down to Georgia. And that's the key to the Declaration of Independence. It was not one colony forming one state. It was the state of Great Britain granting independence to the 13 states of North America. And that term state has meaning, as we've mentioned over and over in the course. And so these states were free to do whatever they wanted, as Jefferson said. They had all the sovereignty and autonomy of an independent state like Great Britain. There was no difference in the two. So when we go forward to our central documents, our governing documents, like the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, that stays the same. Now, there is this argument out there that the Constitution, when we have the Constitution, the states secede from the Articles and then form the Constitution. I think that's correct in some ways and incorrect in others, and of course, John Taylor of Caroline and Abel Upshur point this out. The Union never changed. We go from one Union under the Articles to a more perfect Union under the Constitution. All the states had done is delegated a little more authority to the central government, but the Union didn't change. So essentially what you say is if we are scrapping the Articles and starting over and seceding from the Articles, that lends into the argument that the Constitution is entirely different, that the Union is entirely different. So I think we need to be careful with that argument. At the same time, we all know that the procedure in forming the Constitution was not the procedure that the Articles had for amending the Articles. So in that particular way, you are looking at perhaps a secession from one to the other. And, of course, Rhode Island and North Carolina didn't ratify the document until 1790 and 1789, respectively. So what was the status of those states? Well, of course, they were independent during that time. They were not part of the government under the Constitution, so they were operating under either they're in union with each other, but they really weren't. They were independent states. So you can either call it secession from one to the other, but it more importantly, it was the maintenance of that union where the states had all the power. And that's the most important component looking to understand the bridge between the two. Secession, of course, was also discussed in the early 1790s by Northerners like Rufus King and Oliver Ellsworth. I've mentioned this before, but when they cornered John Taylor of Carolina in a room and said, look, well, why don't we just secede from the Union? So here we are having Northerners openly discuss the issue of secession first, not Southerners. And this is in the 1790s, even before the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. So you have Northerners saying, well, look, let's just get out of the Union. We understand that Virginia, that you all are going to dominate the government. There's no chance for us really to control this government. Let's just get out of it and give it to you. As you're adding states to the West, those states are going to be more like you. They're agricultural states. They're farmers. They're not like us. They're not commercially motivated like we are. And then, of course, you get to the 1798 issue of the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. This is an interesting topic. Dr. Gutzman, of course, did a nice job with this in his particular presentations. And nullification is outlined in the Constitution through the Tenth Amendment. At least that's what Jefferson said in his authoring of the Kentucky Resolves. There were some in the founding generation who thought that nullification, though, was a kind of a silly idea. That if you were looking at the particular issue, you should just secede and forget about nullification. You know, Nathaniel Macon said this. Look, this is dumb. Let's just secede. If you don't like the Union, just get out. And, of course, Virginia had a resumption clause, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. So there was a general opinion circulating around that secession would be the proper remedy here, not nullification. And the interesting thing about Macon, too, is he actually said that the sedition law was clearly unconstitutional. It violated the First Amendment and of course, the Tenth Amendment. But not just that. He said, look, if we want a sedition law, just pass it in your state. You know, have it in North Carolina or have it in Virginia or Massachusetts or New York. But you can't have the central government outlining a sedition law. So this issue of nullification versus secession was clearly articulated in 1798. And then you have the Essex Junto of 1803. People like Timothy Pickering of Massachusetts, who was at one time the Secretary of State, are calling for the secession of the New England states in 1803 because of the Louisiana Purchase. They thought they could see the writing on the wall at this point. My gosh, we're going to have all of these new states come in the Union out of this vast chunk of territory, and they're all going to be farmers. My gosh, we're doomed. All these farmers are going to get involved in the government, and they're all going to vote for the Jeffersonians, and we're never going to get any of our laws passed, so we might as well just get out. And, of course, part of their plan at one point hinged on Aaron Burr, who rejected it because they were looking at maybe if he was the governor of New York, he could be the president of this Northern Confederation. Jefferson said as much in 1801 when he was inaugurated. Look, if there's people that talk about secession, let them be. Let them go. You know, get out of the Union. We can say that they're not right, but let them go. If only it was so easy, and if only it was that easy, you know, 60 years later. And, of course, you know, in our own current time, if only it was that easy, you know, for the president to say, well, look, if you don't want to be in this government anymore, just go on. It's self-determination. That's the American tradition. I think that would be a more responsible thing to do. And, of course, more interested, if you're more interested in the liberty of the people and popular, you know, self-determination, that's what you would say. Now, the Hartford Convention was in two part. It was in some ways a nullification convention. In other ways, it was a secession convention. If you look at the Hartford Convention itself, they were talking about nullifying laws in support of the war and the War of 1812. And they were openly violating these laws, so they were just going to talk about nullifying them anyways. And when you look at the constitutional amendments that they wanted coming out of Hartford, Connecticut, here, they wanted things like abolishing the three-fifths clause of the Constitution and, you know, having a one-term limit for president, making sure that the presidents come from different states each time, because they're concerned they have no power in this government. On the other hand, there were people at the Hartford Convention who were saying at this point, look, let's just leave the Union. We understand Southerners dominate the government. We should not be part of this government. We should just get out of it. And, you know, that was openly discussed. Now, they tried to clamp down on the secessionist talk because they thought that would be disastrous for the Federalist Party, and ultimately it was. By 1820, the Federalist Party is basically gone in terms of the name. Now, the Federalists hung around. They called themselves National Republicans. But this Federalist Party has been discredited. But it didn't stop them from, you know, talking about secession here, and the issue of secession, the idea of secession is being kicked around. And then, of course, you had the abolitionists in the North, all the way up until the 1850s, who talk about secession. They recognized that perhaps the Constitution was a little bit too interested in slavery. It had the Fugitive Slave Law. It had positive protection of slavery. This is what Roger Taney said in 1857. So they believed it. And so you had people like Lysander Spooner, and you had people like William Lloyd Garrison saying that, look, we should just get out of the Union. We don't want to be in the slaveholding republic anymore. We should have our own free republic. And so that was the right thing to do. So abolitionists themselves, this is why it's so crazy in 1860 and 61, and some of the abolitionists were saying, look, this is what we wanted from the beginning. Let the southern states go, because then we get rid of the slaveholding problem. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Now we can have our free republic. Let those 15 southern states go, those 15 slave states, let them have their slave republic. We don't need it anymore. So some of the abolitionists were actually very much in line with this secessionist ideology. Ultimately, though, secession, of course, was discussed and accomplished in the South between 1850 and 1861. I mentioned 1850 because in the Compromise of 1850, you had some pretty ardent secessionist spots in the South, and actually one is fairly close to where I live in Eufaula, Alabama. There's a group there called the Eufaula Regency, and the Eufaula Regency was secessionist to the core. They actually were one of the few places in the South that continued voting for secessionist candidates all the way through the 1850s. So they maintained the secession tradition. And when secession actually occurred between 1860 and 1861, you know, William Lowndes Yancey, who was one of the great fire eaters, so-called fire eaters of the South, made an impassioned speech in favor of secession in Eufaula. And Thomas Jefferson had a relative that lived in Eufaula. So this place was very much a secessionist area of the South. And then ultimately, of course, South Carolina secedes in 1860, December 1860, and then followed by several other states in 1861. So secession is a big issue in American history, all the way from 1776 until 1861. Now, let's move forward and talk about this idea of secession in various ways. The commentaries on the Constitution often raise the issue. And most in that group believed that secession could be accomplished. I mentioned William Rawl in the introduction. He openly said it. Look, the states can secede from the Union. Senator of Delaware that I'll talk about in the presentation on Mr. Lincoln's unconstitutional war, James A. Byard of Delaware, actually wrote a little treatise on the Constitution where he said, well, look, it's legal as long as it's an act of revolution. I mean, you can do that. It happened in 1776. There's nothing saying that you can't do it now. Some Southerners did prefer a Declaration of Independence through an ordinance of secession, but it didn't mean that it couldn't happen. And as I said, disingenuous Northerners. Northerners had been pushing the issue before anybody else in the 1790s, even all the way up until the 1840s and 50s. When the South actually secedes and they say, well, this is illegal, it's impossible. Lincoln said, I've never heard of such an idea before. Well, he's being disingenuous. And when he said, that the United States was one nation, he's being extremely disingenuous because it never had been. So this essentially comes down to the issue of sovereignty and what is the Union? Is it a compact between states? Is it a compact between independent, free and independent states? Or is there a national government that is, supreme? And is this compulsory? As Guru Nomura said, I think that generally the founding generation thought it was not compulsory. It was a federal union. It was not a national government. They weren't forming a national government. They were forming a federal union. And because of that, the states still had all the power. They delegated authority to the central government, and that delegated authority, of course, could be rescinded anytime they chose. So the meaning of union, as articulated in the antebellum period, was simple. It's a compact between states, between the states, so ratifying the same, which meant that secession was perfectly legal. And again, you can look at the idea of the language of the Articles of the Constitution. A lot of the language was just borrowed and carried over. And so that nature of the Union had never changed. The Articles of Confederation was a loose confederation of sovereign, free, and independent states. The Constitution was no different. All the states did was just give some more authority to the central government. They delegated it to it and actually said, we can't do these things, to ensure that the Union operates smoothly. But everything else was left up to them. And when the central government violated that, then it was time to get out of the Union. And I bring up John C. Calhoun's Jefferson Day dinner toast, and this is pretty famous. John C. Calhoun talked about the nature of the Union. This is a legend, but apparently, according to legend, Andrew Jackson, at the annual Jefferson Day dinner, while he was president, of course, it's customary for the president to make a toast. So he stands up and says, "The Union, long may it endure." And this is during the nullification controversy here in the 1830s. And John C. Calhoun follows him and says, "The Union, next to our liberty most dear, may we always remember that it can only be preserved by distributing equally the benefits and burdens of the Union." So he's saying, look, if we don't have our liberty, what's the point of the Union? I mean, my gosh, how great. And this is what, was going on here in the 1860s. And if we don't have our liberty, why have our Union? Because the liberty of our liberty, if it's trampled upon, if our constitutional liberties that are guaranteed through the Constitution are trampled upon, then why are we even involved in this government to begin with? Because if we give up that authority, if we give that completely to the central government, which the central government cannot take, by the way, if we do that, then we're nothing more but servants to the central government. So Calhoun was pretty perceptive here that liberty was more important than union. And I think generally those in the liberty movement would consider that to be true. Again, whether you're a libertarian or a paleoconservative, now neoconservatives are just the scourge of the earth, but whether you're somebody that enjoys liberty and limited central authority and the individualism of that made America great, you're going to agree with Calhoun. So the question is, was secession constitutional? There are several arguments against this, and I've seen all of these things. Let me address them one at a time. The first has to do with Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state may enter into a treaty with another state without the consent of the other states. Now, if secession does not happen in fact, if it doesn't happen, if you believe Lincoln's point that this is simply a rebellion, then the Confederacy was illegal. But Lincoln himself recognized through several of his actions that this was not just a rebellion. By blockading the southern states, he's recognizing the southern states as a separate entity. He's recognizing those governments as out of the Union. So if you believe that secession can actually happen, if you believe in the American principle that, my gosh, we have seceded from the British Empire, then these states can leave the Union too, and so the Constitution is null and void in that way. It doesn't even apply to these states anymore. So this is the argument, the counterweight to this argument. The states left the Union, so therefore Article 1, Section 10 does not apply to them. It applies to the states in the Union, but if you're out of the Union, it doesn't apply to you anymore. And I think that's the easiest way to explain this particular part and this particular argument against secession. It does not apply. And it hangs people up all the time. I've had several emails over the years. Well, I've been reading the Constitution. You said that secession is perfectly possible. Then I get to Article 1, Section 10, and it just throws me off. Well, it shouldn't, because if the states leave the Union, then they're no longer bound by Article 1, Section 10. This idea of one people and a perpetual national government. First of all, as Abel Upshur pointed out very clearly in destroying Joseph Story, we've never been one people. I also mentioned this in the U.S. history course. There's never been one people of the United States. There still isn't one people of the United States, and everyone clearly knows it. There are differences between Northerners and Southerners and Westerners and Northerners and Westerners and Southerners and different ethnic groups and religions and all kinds of things. I mean, now even different language barriers in the United States. To say that we're all one people is just crazy. I think we clearly see that, and we can see that in the 2012 election and some of the gaps that we have, whether it's, by race, for example, or by ethnic origin or whatever you take. I mean, people understand that there is diversity in the United States. And so because of that, and we even had diversity in the United States in the 18th century and the 17th century, because of that, we've never been one people. So this forcing of this national government, which it was never designed to be, is destructive and detrimental and, quite honestly, the antithesis of the American tradition. The federal government allowed for this great diversity of the United States. It allowed for different communities to have their own ethnic differences and to have their own laws and local customs and all of these wonderful things that, Americans generally like. I mean, we like different types of food and things like. We like these things. We like going different places and seeing different people. People like coming to the South and learning what the South is all about. And Southerners sometimes like going to the North. I say sometimes like going to the North and finding out what Northerners were all about. I mean, so, we like these things and we recognize that there are differences, and a federal union can make that work very well. But when you have a national government, it destroys that. And so the founders didn't consider us the United States a nation. It was the United States, the style of which will be the United States, of course, united being in lowercase in the Declaration, it never was one government. And, of course, the idea of a perpetual national government. Well, it never was a national government to begin with, but perpetual. What does that term perpetual mean? It's used in the Articles of Confederation, but I think that we have to be careful with that. Because every contract is deemed to be perpetual, but we all know contracts can be broken. There's ways you have to do it, whether it's, buy yourself out. And, of course, Southerners were trying to buy federal property and forts and harbors and things like that. They were trying to buy that property and pay their debt and do what they had to do to get out of the Union. They were very clearly engaged in this, and it's just Lincoln never wanted to listen to them. Because I don't think he really believed they were serious. That's Lincoln's fault. He's a terrible politician, regardless of what Steven Spielberg says. And, the fact is that something's only perpetual if the two parties make it perpetual, whether it's a personal contract or a contract between states. It can't be perpetual if one party to the contract wants to get out of it. And then there's this argument, of course, we could say that maybe the original 13 states had a right to secession, but not the rest. I mean, there's no way that Alabama had a right to secession, because Alabama was created out of the territory of the United States. Well, Jefferson's response to that was, that's hogwash. That's baloney. You're being bamboozled when you believe that, because as we bring in the states, as Jefferson clearly said in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, these states were on equal footing with the existing states. So they were the same thing. They were free and independent states. And my gosh, how could you not say Texas didn't have a right to secede? Texas was an independent country for 9 years, for goodness sake. So here's Texas saying they want out of the Union. They should have that right. Anybody should have that right to leave the Union. It is the right of self-determination. So this idea that the states, once they were created out of the territory, they can no longer secede. Well, then you basically are saying then the 13 states couldn't secede from the British Empire because they were created out of territory that was part of the British Empire. This is a preposterous argument, and it's a weak argument. And I think that when you see it, you should laugh, because this is how stupid it actually is. All these arguments are kind of foolish, at times we've all looked at it and said, I'm kind of confused about this, but this particular argument is pretty stupid and pretty silly. But it's often thrown out there. South Carolina could secede, but Mississippi couldn't secede. There's no way. Or Florida. I mean, Florida can't get out of the Union. That's just crazy. This is just crazy radical stuff that we're talking about here. I mean, this is what people will tell you. these right wingers, these guys that just want to, you know, to have slavery. That's what secession's always been about. And then you can come back and say, well, hey, what about the abolitionists that wanted to secede? were they about slavery? I guess, you know, they wanted to have slaves too. These abolitionists wanted to own slaves, obviously, because that's what secession's always about. Now, the arguments for, some of the things I've already kind of talked about, so let me hit on these again. Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island all included resumption clauses in their ratification of the Constitution. So essentially, if the Constitution began, or the central government began to abuse their powers, then Virginia, New York, and Rhode Island could get out of the Union. Quite simple. You know, just, if it doesn't work for us, we're gone. Sayonara, see you later, have a good day, arrivederci, we're out. And that's one of the best arguments to show that when the states were looking at this Constitution, every state had this idea, and they had it, if they didn't even put the resumption clauses in there, other states had it when they asked for a 10th Amendment in their proposed Bill of Rights. And generally, that was the First Amendment. So they said, look, one of the things we need to do is protect ourselves from the central government with a 10th Amendment type amendment. They're looking at the Articles of Confederation for an example there, because it was explicitly stated in the Articles of Confederation that the states retain their sovereignty. So what they're doing in this 10th Amendment is saying, well, if we don't delegate this power to you, we have it. The people of the state still have it. You can't take it from us, no matter what you say. And if you start abusing that, well, of course, we can get out of this government. It's also a compact between the states, so ratifying the same. So it's between states. If one state starts abusing that compact, then the thing falls apart. The other states can get out of it. It's not a compact between people and the federal government. It's a compact between the states. The states. And they created the federal government. It's one of the most wonderful arguments for secession, that the states, because they created the federal government, can leave it. They can destroy it. This is essentially what John Tyler said. President John Tyler said that the states can destroy the government, the central government, but the central government cannot destroy the states. And I talk about that in my Forgotten Conservatives in American History. I also have a YouTube video about that out there in my Founding Perspective channel. So go out there and watch it. I mean, it's only 10 minutes, and I talk about this particular issue. So the states can destroy the central government, but the central government cannot destroy the states. I've already mentioned this transition from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution and what that meant. You had, because the Union stayed the same, it didn't change, that secession was a distinct possibility. And then, of course, if you look at it in the way of secession, that the Constitution, the states seceded from the Articles of Confederation and wrote the Constitution, I mean, there's another fine argument for secession. And again, right to self-determination. Now, this is the American tradition. If we don't have a right of self-determination, we're not here. We're still singing God Save the Queen. And so we have that right of self-determination, as we've recognized all around the world at various times. When we supported, say, for example, the secession of the Eastern Bloc countries from the Soviet Union, rah, rah, yeah, go Eastern Bloc countries, but if, you know, Vermont wants to secede, no, hell no, you can't do that. Or if Louisiana wants to secede, you can't do that. Or if Montana wants to secede, no, you can't do that. Even Hawaii and Alaska, which have a pretty strong claim, or Texas, you can't secede, you can't do that. Once you join the Union, you're in it forever. And this is such a silly argument. Once you join something, you're in it forever. You can't get out. Once you're in, you can't get out. This is a bizarro world. In no other world does that exist in America. Once you're in it, you can't get out. Unless it's the mafia. So I guess the United States government is the mafia. Because that's really what you're looking at here. And again, it's an extra constitutional action. The Constitution does not apply. So that argument, the first argument I gave you, doesn't apply at all, because once the states left the Union through their ordinances of secession, they're out. And so the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, does not apply. Of course, Abraham Lincoln is a sectional president. Everyone knew it. 1860, the election rolls around. Lincoln gets less than 40% of the popular vote. He does win the election because we have a four-way split, and so he picks up the most electoral college votes, but he's not even on the ballot in many southern states. So people have looked at this and said, my gosh, we're done. I think if you did a man on the street interview, you know, go out with Jay Leno and do those, you know, man on the street, or you know, take your pick of media personality that says, hey, what do you think about this or this? You know, people would probably tell you that Abraham Lincoln got like 75 or 85 or 95% of the popular vote because everybody loved him. You know, they might take into account if they're smart enough that, well, you know, probably the South didn't vote for him, but still, that would mean he at least got, what, 60% of the vote? Because every Northerner loved him. I mean, that's the way people think about this. But that wasn't the case at all. Less than 40%. I think it was like 39.4 is what it came down to. I mean, this is crazy. This guy, who didn't believe the secession was actually going to take place, he thought if he shot, you know, if the Union showed showed their army and showed their teeth, so to speak, and shot their weapons a few times, these Southerners would give up. He obviously doesn't know what he's talking about. Lincoln denied that the right of secession existed, though it had already taken place de facto. In fact, this is really interesting. The majorities for secession in 1861 were greater than the support for the American War for Independence. These secession conventions, all this happened through the popular will of the people. Every single state in the South had a secession convention. And that convention idea, as I've mentioned in another presentation, is purely American. The people speaking their voice through a convention. We can still do these things. It's actually in the Constitution. You can have conventions to amend the Constitution. We haven't had one in, I don't even know how long. I don't remember the last time when we were trying to get rid of the 18th Amendment, there were conventions. That's it. So, my gosh, if we could just have some conventions and talk about these things and talk about the issues that are affecting the United States, but you'd have to have some people that are actually engaged and know what the heck they're talking about. That is my greatest fear about amending the Constitution. Nobody's going to even, we're more likely to get, you know, Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights than we are a federalism amendment or perhaps, you know, some type of amendment that would limit the power of the executive, maybe give them a one-term limit, maybe 6 years, something like that. I mean, that's the stuff we're going to get. But the majorities in 1861, this was the will of the people. And you hear people say it wasn't. It's this oligarchic government. It was, you know, tyranny. No way. These were popularly elected conventions, and the will of the people said with vast majorities that they wanted out of the government. I mean, what other argument do you have against this? Some, again, as I mentioned before, like the Lee family, preferred a declaration of independence because that would have settled the issue. Look, we've declared our independence. We're out of this. It's no ordinance of secession. We're just breaking from the Constitution. I think that would have helped the language issue in this particular case. But it's an ordinance of secession, declaration of independence, virtually the same thing. And what's really interesting is that some Northerners even recognize this had happened. In fact, there was this proposal to put forward an amendment to the Constitution which would prohibit further secession. So by saying that we're going to prohibit further secession, they're recognizing secession's already happened. It's already taken place. That government is there, and we need to deal with that. So when Lincoln has his undeclared war, which was illegal, and committing treason basically by doing it and blockading the ports, regardless of what the Supreme Court said, secession had actually happened. And so, again, if we recognize that in the process, that this is a popular vote, this is the popular will of the people, that secession actually happened, then Lincoln becomes the greatest tyrant in so many ways in American history. By mobilizing for war, Lincoln recognizes de facto secession. The constitutional issue of war, as I'll address in the next presentation, is an unconstitutional war, so I'm not going to steal my own thunder in the next presentation. And, of course, I just mentioned this Lincoln and treason, which I get into also in the next presentation. So, you know, Lincoln was waging war against them, meaning he was waging war against the states. That's treason. So if secession did not take place, then Lincoln should be hung for treason, should have been hung for treason, should be convicted of treason. It's interesting is that Liberty University, I believe, actually had years ago a mock trial. They put Jefferson Davis on trial, and Jefferson Davis won because... They were able to prove the secession was not illegal. And of course, sending troops into a neighboring state without a request from the governor or the legislature, George Washington set this precedent in the Whiskey Rebellion, unfortunately, but Lincoln was doing that by sending troops into the South. The governors in the states did not ask for these, so he's invading a state without their consent. He's violating the Constitution. So calling Lincoln a despot and a tyrant is perfectly fine, because that's what he was. He was a despot and a tyrant. He was a dictator. And he's just getting warmed up at the beginning and all the other unconstitutional legislation that we're going to get later on. So this is a huge issue, and I hope I've explained some of the arguments for and against secession, kind of the background to this. And when you go out there and are talking with your friends or your enemies about what secession means, you have the ammunition you need to just lay them down and lay them low and put them in their place. And as Tom Woods said in the beginning, in the introduction to Liberty Classroom, we give you this stuff so you don't have to write us and say, hey, you know, thanks for taking this person down, or what should I say about this? Well, now you know what you should say about this. Go out there and do your own work and spread the message, because this thing could grow exponentially. You know, it took the progressives over 100 years to get where they are. And it might take us 100 years to do the same thing, but if the fire of liberty is there, if it's burning and people understand the rights of limited government and the original union, I think we can change this. And it all comes down to you. So, again, I